What happens when, a child's imaginary game of make-believe leaves deep physical scratch marks in the dirt?
Right, it completely upends how we think about play.
Exactly. Because we usually look back at childhood games through this lens of pure innocence, right? You throw a towel over your shoulders, you run around the backyard, and it's totally harmless. But you brought us a really fascinating collection of narrative logs today. They detail the lives of a group of kids in the town of Ainaton. And the sources you shared, I mean, they completely shatter that watercolor
They
illusion.
really do.
The line between their psychological coping mechanisms and actual terrifying reality doesn't just blur here, it breaks entirely.
Yeah, we are basically looking at a masterclass in world building. These kids aren't just playing. They are actively constructing this psychological architecture to survive their environment.
Wow.
What begins as a really simple diversion evolves into a complex system for processing trauma, establishing social hierarchies, and ultimately, and this is the crazy part, confronting an unexplainable physical anomaly.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Our mission with your sources today is to explore the intricate mechanics of this childhood imagination. We're going to examine how these specific kids use high fantasy role play to navigate the brutal reality of their town, and then we'll dissect that pivotal moment where the monster they invented seemingly manifests in the dark.
Yes.
Okay, let's unpack this. Where does the genesis of this particular fantasy actually take root?
So the inception occurs indoors. It's entirely bounded by the safety of this middle-class, green-themed bedroom.
Right.
We meet Rebecca, who is a highly articulate, red-haired teenager, and Alice, who's a 10-year-old blonde girl.
And the visual contrast between them is striking,
Yo,
right?
absolutely. Because Alice is lugging around this oversized, heavy adult purse alongside a stuffed black unicorn named Lord Mel.
I love Lord Mel.
Right. And they initiate their playtime by mimicking the adult world. Specifically, they're playing cutthroat corporate lawyers.
Which is so funny to picture. The power dynamics in that initial game are just fascinating. Rebecca demands black coffee.
Right, as a corporate lawyer would.
Exactly. Which Alice dutifully serves out of a plastic teacup. And they negotiate imaginary lawsuit settlements. But the logs show Rebecca growing visibly bored almost immediately.
Yeah, she really hits a wall. The adult world, even a high-powered corporate version of it, is too constrained for her. It operates on rules she already feels oppressed by, you know?
Makes sense.
So she hits the ceiling of mundane reality and aggressively pivots. Rebecca declares she doesn't want to play lawyers anymore, and she outright rejects the traditional default of playing house.
She wants more power.
Exactly. She reaches for an archetype of ultimate unbound agency. She names herself Nimue of the Lake, a powerful sorceress.
Naturally.
Right. She repurposes her father's black graduation gown into a mystic robe and claims a candlestick as her wand.
That is so creative.
It really is. And crucially, she brings Alice into this new paradigm, renaming the 10-year-old Princess Angela Healer of the Sick.
Okay, I have to challenge the dynamic there for a second.
Yeah.
Because at first glance, Rebecca looks like she's just being the bossy older kid,
Right.
like unilaterally changing the rules and completely renaming her playmate. But looking at the psychological utility of that moment, maybe she's actually creating a highly tailored, empowering space for Alice.
What's fascinating here is the neuro-linguistic reframing Rebecca is orchestrating. By rejecting roles like secretary or mother in favor of sorceress, she establishes a matriarchy of immense arcane power.
Oh, wow.
But she assigns Alice a role that anchors perfectly to the younger girl's physical reality.
Because of the purse.
Exactly. Alice is dubbed the healer because inside that oversized adult purse, she is carrying real medical supplies, like actual Bactine and Band-Aids.
That's brilliant.
Right. So Rebecca handles the abstract cosmic power, while Alice is given immense value through a tangible, nurturing role she can execute in the real world.
They are literally renaming their reality to control it. Like Alice's cotton balls and Bactine become puffy fluff balls of healing. And that isn't just a cute quirk, right? It's a brilliant cognitive tool. A child reclaiming agency over pain by turning a stinging medical spray into a magical elixir.
It's powerful psychological armor.
And they need that armor because they immediately take this fantasy out of the bedroom and test it against the harsh social hierarchy of the public square.
Yeah, so the setting shifts to the Siège des Anges, which is a park across from the grade school centered around a bronze angel statue.
Right, very public, exposed place.
Exactly. Here, the insulated fantasy collides with actual physical threat. We are introduced to Thomas, an athletic 14-year-old observing from a tree, and Simon.
Poor Simon.
Yeah, Simon is a much smaller, mousy kid weighed down by a heavy backpack, and he is actively being terrorized by Boris, an older, muscular, former star athlete.
The logs frame this as a classic terrifying middle school power imbalance, but Thomas intervenes, and not with physical force, which I found so interesting.
No, not at all. He utilizes pure diplomacy. He walks along a retaining wall, literally placing himself on a higher physical plane.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, it's a great tactical move, and he casually de-escalates the violence by appealing directly to the bully's ego. He tells Boris, look at him go, he's terrified of you.
Right.
And he reminds Boris that the younger kids look up to him because of his athletic past.
So Thomas basically neutralizes the threat by offering Boris a narrative where he is a respected leader rather than a cruel enforcer.
Exactly. And meanwhile, Alice reacts entirely within her established character framework.
Oh my gosh.
She chases down the fleeing, terrified Simon to administer completely unnecessary amounts of her magical healing supplies.
Because Simon trips and scrapes his knees.
Right. And Alice practically turns him into a mummy to prevent what she calls an inflection.
An inflection. Simon's reaction in that moment is a masterclass in deflection, honestly.
Oh, go.
He's bleeding, he's just been bullied, and Alice is smothering him in bandages. And Alice mentions a local superstition that if the Pars Angel statue ever draws its sword, it signals the apocalypse, but she mispronounces it apocalypse.
Right, apocalypse.
And Simon, without missing a single beat, quips that an apocalypse is when the cow gets into the dog's food.
It's such a great line.
It really is. I want you to think about how you process high-stress environments. Have you ever deployed humor or slipped into a hyper-competent persona to deflect the situation where you felt completely powerless? Because Simon is doing it at a literal survival level.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, we observe how trauma is instantly metabolized by the group's shared fiction.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just patch Simon up physically, they absorb his victimization into their lore. Rebecca officially dubs their group the Court of Mirari.
Which comes from a Latin root for wonder or amazement, right?
Exactly. And she inducts Simon as the court jester. Thomas is knighted Lord Thomas the Explorer.
The jester role is so important, it fundamentally changes Simon's relationship to his own humiliation.
How so?
Well, he's no longer a scrawny kid being shoved into the dirt against his will, you know? By codifying his clumsiness as a vital, accepted performance for a royal court, he takes ownership of his physical vulnerability.
That's a great point. He controls the narrative of his own stumbles. So, having formalized their adventuring party, the Court of Mirari obviously requires a quest.
Naturally.
And they utilize the physical geometry of the park to generate one. They decide they must locate a key to rescue their missing king.
And Alice helpfully points out that the king is literally just her father, King Dean Westfield, whose royal duty involves fixing Oldsmobiles.
I love how they just incorporate that.
Right. The older kids effortlessly weave that mundane reality back into the high fantasy.
Yeah, Thomas analyzes the strange geometric circles of black and white stone paving the park. He theorizes the key's location can be mapped by tracking where the angel statue's shadow falls on the flagpole at a specific hour.
They are turning their civic infrastructure into a puzzle box.
Yeah, really are. So the narrative advances to Saturday, where the group encounters Agatha in the park. She is a tall, red-headed teenager, fiercely practicing drawing a wooden sword near the statue.
And she accidentally catches her skin on the sword chain, creating a blister.
Which means Alice immediately deploys her healing potions.
Obviously.
Agatha is inducted as a knight, Lady Redmayne. And a newly minted knight requires a dragon to slay.
Right.
So Thomas volunteers for the role, designating a cave on a remote incline called One Eyes Hill as his lair.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because the escalation here feels dangerously steep to me.
Yeah.
They transition from playing in a manicured public park to marching into the actual woods, up a remote hill, toward an unlit natural cave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are dragging younger, vulnerable kids into an uncontrolled environment just to validate a new friend's pretend knight persona. The physical risk heavily outweighs the game.
It does, but that boundary pushing is the fundamental engine of adolescent development.
Mm-hmm.
They're testing the structural integrity of the psychological armor they've built.
I guess that's true.
And the logs detail how they solidify their courage through the spontaneous creation of tangible props.
Right, like Simon's mask.
Yes. Simon crafts a dragon muzzle from construction paper. Agatha draws a coat of arms onto a paper shield using crayons, and Alice brings real metallic costume jewelry to serve as the dragon's hoard. They're manufacturing physical anchors to keep themselves tethered to the shared fiction as they enter a genuinely intimidating space.
That makes a lot of sense, and the execution at One Eyes Hill starts exactly according to their script, initially. Thomas ties a towel around his neck for a cape, dons the paper muzzle, and dramatically kidnaps Alice, carrying her into the dark mouth of the cave.
Right.
Agatha mounts her attack with the wooden sword and paper shield. Alice sits on the cave floor, arranging her jewelry hoard and playfully blowing raspberries at the pretend monster.
But the script shatters instantly when the environment introduces an uncontrolled variable. The growl. While Thomas and Agatha mock fight near the entrance, Alice, who is deeper inside, hears a noise. It is not Thomas making a sound effect.
Oh.
It is a very real, incredibly low growl vibrating from the deepest, blackest part of the cavern.
Just imagine being 10 years old, sitting in the dark, fully immersed in a game about monsters, and suddenly the darkness organically growls back.
It's terrifying.
Alice's reaction isn't theatrical at all. It is a visceral, biological panic. She scrambles backward, completely abandoning the Princess Angela persona, trips over a fallen branch, and tumbles wildly down the steep side of the hill, screaming for her mother.
And the contrast in Thomas's behavior highlights the abrupt collapse of the cognitive framework.
Mm-hmm.
Because seconds before the growl, he had caught Agatha's wooden sword under his arm, performing a highly exaggerated theatrical death sequence.
But he drops the act the millisecond the low frequency hits his ears. The towel cape becomes totally irrelevant. In his pure panic, Thomas grabs the wooden sword, actually gripping it by the wooden blade rather than the handle,
right,
and screams for Agatha to run because the threat in the cave is biological, not imaginary.
This raises an important question regarding the mechanics of cognitive dissonance during an adrenaline spike.
Oh, how so?
Well, when the brain is deeply engaged in magical thinking, how does it process an authentic sudden threat? The nervous system shifts entirely to survival mode. But the interpretive lens, the vocabulary they have readily available, is still heavily saturated with magic.
Which perfectly sets up the chaos at the bottom of the hill.
Exactly.
Alice stops tumbling, sobbing, and curled into a ball against a tree. And the logs state that a large black equine figure thunders out of the woods, leaps entirely over Alice's huddled body, charges back up the hill toward the source of the growl, and lets out a yelp.
Yeah.
Alice hysterically, stubbornly insists to the group that this creature was Lord Mel. Her small, plush, stuffed black unicorn supposedly grew to massive proportions and animated to save her.
So from a psychological standpoint, we have to look at memory contamination and folie à deux, a shared delusion.
Okay, walk me through that.
Agatha was chasing Alice down the hill. She encounters a babbling, highly traumatized child, repeating that Lord Mel just leapt over her.
Right.
Agatha's brain, flooded with adrenaline and already primed by hours of high fantasy roleplay, retroactively edits her own visual processing. Agatha claims she also saw the horse and specifically noted a flash of red at its neck matching the stuffed toy's red mane.
See, I am going to stop you right there and push back hard on the shared delusion theory.
Okay, let's hear it.
I understand memory contamination, but you cannot explain away the physical aftermath. Agatha takes Alice to Danswick's stables to treat her scrapes and asks Fred, the stable hand, if a black horse broke loose.
Mm-hmm.
Fred confirms their only horse is a pony named Raff, who is absolutely not black. And while the girls are at the stables, Thomas and Simon, operating completely outside of that immediate hysterical feedback loop, return to the cave entrance.
That's true. They do.
They don't find a hallucination. They find Alice's costume jewelry scattered across the dirt, surrounded by deep, violent, unexplained scratch marks.
And the inclusion of the physical evidence is what makes this log so compelling. The narrative refuses to let the reader rest comfortably on a psychological diagnosis.
Exactly.
Thomas uses a flashlight to crawl into the specific dark hole where the growl originated. He documents hearing strange echoing whines.
Creepy.
Very. And more importantly, he discovers a geological anomaly, a narrower, deeper tunnel dropping at a steep 70-degree incline, descending at least 20 feet into the earth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he is forced to turn back because navigating it requires a rope.
So there is a localized physical reality beneath that hill that actively defies the logic of their town. They brushed up against something fundamentally unexplainable, and yet the relentless machinery of normal life just drags them forward.
Yeah, Monday comes for us all.
Right. After a weekend of battling an unknown entity, Monday morning arrives. The kids are forced to reassemble their shattered reality inside the high-vaulted, fluorescent-lit, mural-covered cafeteria of their school.
And the environmental transition is really jarring, but the psychological bleed-over is seamless. The rigid, unmagical structure of the school day cannot overwrite the mystery of the cave. They're physically eating lunch, but mentally, the Cordamerari is still active.
Because Simon is utilizing a real-world survival tactic that mirrors his fantasy role, right?
Yes. He reveals to the group that he intentionally hides a nickel inside his sock. He allows the older bullies to corner him and steal the rest of his lunch money, satisfying their aggression so they leave him physically unharmed.
That is incredibly sad, but also brilliant.
It is. He dictates the terms of his own defeat to ensure his survival. And Rebecca, maintaining her role as the benevolent sorceress, silently slides a dime from her own tray over to Simon so he can afford food.
It is a literal microeconomy of survival.
Exactly.
And across the table, Thomas is entirely detached from the cafeteria politics. He is drafting a complex map of the cave system on a paper napkin. The terrifying encounter didn't repel him, it radicalized his curiosity.
Yeah, he is actively planning the logistics of acquiring a rope to explore that 20-foot drop-off.
While Thomas maps the descent, Alice takes inventory of her recovered hoard. She realizes her gold unicorn earrings, a prize gift from Rebecca, are missing. They deduce the earrings were lost during the frantic scramble at the cave mouth, or worse, they tumbled down Thomas's dark, echoing tunnel. And right at that moment of realization, a hall monitor interrupts the table, handing Rebecca a summons to the principal's office.
Such a tense moment.
The log ends on that incredibly tense bureaucratic cliffhanger. So, what does this all mean? We have a group of kids operating on two completely different frequencies simultaneously.
It perfectly illustrates the cognitive dissonance of adolescence. The missing gold unicorn earrings operate as a brilliant thematic anchor.
How do you mean?
They represent the lingering, undeniable tether to the magic and the very real physical danger of One Eyes Hill. They left a piece of their constructed reality down in the dark.
Wow.
And the sudden summons to the principal's office serves as the ultimate unavoidable intrusion of adult authority, rupturing the cord of Merari exactly when they are planning their return to the anomaly.
We followed these kids from the safe pastel confines of a bedroom where they learned to rename their fears out into a park where they weaponized diplomacy against bullies.
Right.
We watched them march into a physically dangerous cavern, encounter a growl that shattered their game, and grapple with physical evidence of a phantom rescue, only to end up right back under the humming lights of a middle school cafeteria. The logs demonstrate that childhood imagination is not a fragile watercolor painting.
Definitely.
It is a robust, highly adaptable psychological tool set required for processing terror, formalizing alliances, and surviving the brutal transition into the adult world.
I really want you to think about the psychological architecture you built when you were young. What was the Lord Mel in your life?
That's a great question.
What childhood talisman or secret irrational belief do you still secretly hope will leap out of the woods to intercept the threat when the darkness in your adult life starts to growl? We all constructed that armor, whether it was made of neuro-linguistic reframing or just crayons and construction paper.
Absolutely.
I'll leave you with one final provocative thought regarding the Court of Merari. What if those missing gold unicorn earrings didn't just accidentally slip into the dirt during a panic? What if they were the required toll? A payment exacted by whatever biological reality is breathing at the bottom of that 20-foot drop-off. And if the toll has been paid, what exactly is waiting in the dark for Thomas when he finally brings his rope? Keep asking questions and stay insanely curious.